Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024. The Senate moves towards passage of a $95 billion bill to provide money to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, and potentially ban the TikTok video app in the United States. Senators vote to not allow amendments and then vote to limit debate. Former President Donald Trump blames current President Joe Biden for the recent pro-Palestinian protests on many college and university campuses around the country. President Biden in Tampa, Florida, blames former President Donald Trump for a six-week abortion ban law that goes into effect in a week. Two Supreme Court oral arguments today, one on immigration and the recourse available to a U.S. citizen's non-citizen spouse who was denied a visa for tattoos deemed to be gang-affiliated, something he denies. And the second on labor law, when the National Labor Relations Board can get a preliminary injunction to have fired workers rehired while their case is pending. In this case, coffee chain Starbucks fired seven baristas, allegedly for union organizing. And the new acting Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Adrian Todman, discusses housing affordability at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Story from ABC News, the Senate on Tuesday cleared a hurdle toward the passage of a package to deliver $95 billion in foreign aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. In clearing a series of test votes, the Senate inches closer to the passage of the legislation, which includes four bills that passed in the House over the weekend with bipartisan support. The package provides roughly $26 billion for Israel, currently at war with Hamas in Gaza, as well as $61 billion for Ukraine and $8 billion for allies in the Indo-Pacific. A fourth bill would force a U.S. ban of TikTok if its Chinese parent company doesn't sell it, impose sanctions on Russia, China, and Iran, and seize Russian assets to help Ukraine rebuild from the war's damage. That was from ABC News. One of the test votes was cloture, which limits debate. 60 votes were needed. It passed 80 to 19. The noes included 17 Republicans and two members of the Democratic caucus, Democrat Jeff Merkley of Oregon and Independent Bernie Sanders of Vermont. After that vote, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, spoke on the Senate floor.
Today, the Senate sends a unified message to the entire world. America will always defend democracy in its hour of need. We tell our allies, we will stand with you. We tell our adversaries, don't mess with us. We tell the world, we will do everything to defend democracy and our way of life. In a resounding bipartisan vote, the relentless work of six long months has paid off. Congress is sending the supplemental to President Biden's desk. Getting this done was one of the greatest achievements the Senate has faced in years, perhaps decades. A lot of people inside and outside the Congress wanted this package to fail. But today, those in Congress who stand on the side of democracy are winning the day. To our friends in Ukraine, to our allies in NATO, to our allies in Israel, and to civilians around the world in need of help, help is on the way. To our friends in Ukraine, America will deliver more ammo and air defenses and basic supplies that you need to resist Putin on the battlefield. To our friends in Israel, America will soon deliver aid to help you fight the scourge of Hamas and stand up to Iran. To innocent civilians in the midst of the war, in the midst of war, from Gaza to Sudan, America will deliver food and medicine and clothing. And to our friends in the Indo-Pacific, we will stand with you to resist the Chinese Communist Party. And to the whole world, make no mistake, America will deliver on its promise to act like a leader on the world stage, to hold the line against autocratic thugs like Vladimir Putin.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, on the Senate floor. The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, also supported this $95 billion foreign aid bill.
Today, the Senate sits for a test on behalf of the entire nation. It's a test of American resolve, our readiness, and our willingness to lead. And the stakes of failure are abundantly clear. failure to help Ukraine stand against Russian aggression now means inviting escalation against our closest treaty allies and trading partners. It means greater risk that American forces would become involved in conflict. It means more costly deployments of our military and steeper military requirements to defend against aggression. Failure to reestablish deterrence against Iran means encouraging unchecked terrorist violence against American personnel, our ally Israel, and the international commerce that underpins our prosperity. And failure to match the passing threat, the People's Republic of China, means jeopardizing the entire system of alliances that preserve American interests and reinforce American leadership. Colleagues on both sides of the aisle who dismiss the value of our allies and partners ignore what history teaches about times when we lacked such friendships.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, on the Senate floor. Later at a news conference, he was asked why so many Republicans are still opposing aid to Ukraine.
I think the demonization of Ukraine began by Tucker Carlson, who, in my opinion, ended up where he should have been all along, which is interviewing Vladimir Putin. And so he had an enormous audience, which convinced a lot of rank-and-file Republicans that maybe this was a mistake. I think the former president had sort of mixed views on it.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Before the Senate voted 80-19 to limit debate on the $95 billion foreign aid bill that includes that aid to Ukraine, it voted against allowing amendments to be offered. That vote was 48-50. The motion was offered by Senator Mike Lee, Republican of Utah, who said on the Senate floor why he thought it was necessary and why he thought the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer had taken steps to block the amendments.
Now, why wouldn't he want amendments? That is, after all, the hallmark characteristic of what defines us as a body. It's why we call ourselves the world's greatest deliberative legislative body. So why wouldn't he want those? Well, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that an amendment might point to some of the weaknesses in the bill, some of the defects of the bill. It might prompt members to, I don't know, slow down and ask whether this is a prudent idea to send a lot of humanitarian aid to Gaza, up to $9.5 billion of it that could go there, with minimal guardrails, where Hamas will with certainty seize it to wage war against Israel. Or if the U.S. taxpayer should be footing the bill for quote-unquote gender advisors in Ukraine's military. Should they really vote for a bill that does this? That's what an amendment forces all of us to ask ourselves and decide on one particular question or another. But leadership in the Senate wants to avoid these thorny questions that might rock the boat. Leadership wants to ram this bill through the Senate with minimal debate and perhaps no amendments, because they know that aspects of it, especially the $60 billion for Ukraine, are massively controversial with the American people, those who elected us, those who pay taxes to fund these efforts. Now, my colleagues and I are working in good faith to reach a unanimous consent agreement to bring forward a handful of amendments and set up a standalone vote in exchange for expediting the passage of the bill. We nearly had that agreement locked in late Friday night. An agreement to vote on just two amendments and one standalone bill. But a couple of senators on the other side of the aisle panicked and started objecting to any and all agreements. They panicked because they knew that one of those items set up as part of a UC, the standalone legislation, to redesignate the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization, this amendment offered up by my friend and colleague, the senator from Texas, might actually pass. Remember, this is the same entity that's been firing on U.S. forces in the region and those of our allies. And yet, they couldn't let that happen. Democrats will agree only to amendments that they find politically palatable or know will not pass.
Senator Mike Lee, Republican from Utah, before the Senate voted not to allow amendments to the $95 billion foreign aid bill for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, voted with Senator Lee and other Republicans to allow amendments. Senator Sanders said before that on the Senate floor that he has two he wanted to offer dealing with Israel's war with Hamas.
I strongly support the humanitarian aid included in this bill, which will save many thousands of lives in Gaza, Sudan, Ukraine, and many other places. Strongly support it. I strongly support getting Ukraine the military aid it needs to defend itself against Putin's imperialist war. I support the Iron Dome to protect Israeli civilians from missile and drone attacks. But let me be very clear. I strongly support ending the provision which will give $8.9 billion in unfettered offensive military aid to the extremist Israeli government. A government led by Prime Minister Netanyahu, who is continuing his unprecedented assault against the Palestinian people. I also strongly oppose language in this legislation that would prohibit funding for UNRWA, the UN organization that is the backbone of the humanitarian relief operation in Gaza, and the only organization that experts say has the capability to provide the humanitarian aid that is desperately needed there. And I have filed two amendments to address these issues. These amendments would not touch funding for the Iron Dome and other purely defensive systems to protect Israel against incoming missiles. Mr. President, as we all know, Hamas, a terrorist organization, began this war with a horrific attack on Israel that killed 1,200 innocent men, women, and children, and took more than 230 captives, some of whom remain today in captivity. As I've said many times, Israel has and had the absolute right to defend itself against this terrorist attack. But Israel did not and does not have the right to go to war against the entire Palestinian people, which is exactly what it is doing.
Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, on the Senate floor before the Senate voted not to allow amendments and then voted to limit debate on the $95 billion bill that aids Ukraine, Israel, and Indo-Pacific partners of the United States, including Taiwan. Also in that package, a requirement that TikTok's Chinese parent company ByteDance sell the video app or have it banned in the United States. Senator Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, chair of the Intelligence Committee, and Senator Maria Cantwell, Democrat from Washington State, chair of the Commerce Committee, spoke about it on the Senate floor today. Jimmy Quinn, national security correspondent with National Review, posting on X about this colloquy. With the forced divestiture provision very likely to become law, sounds like the two Senate committee chairs want to explain the point of the bill to help it survive an expected legal challenge from ByteDance and TikTok. Here's some of the exchange with the senators.
A succession of now declassified intelligence assessments have described the ways in which foreign adversaries, like Iran, like the People's Republic of China, and others, are seeking to stoke social, racial, and political tensions in the United States. They are seeking to undermine confidence in our institutions and our election systems, and even to sow violence amongst Americans. The extent to which our adversaries have exploited American social media platforms is a matter of public record. The committee I chair has held many hearings, open hearings, on the failure of U.S. social media platforms to identify the exploitation of their products by foreign intelligence services. As Senator, along with the Senator from Washington, I've been one of the leading critics of these platforms for their repeated failures to protect consumers. And while the exploitation of U.S. communication platforms by adversaries continues to be a serious issue, at the end of the day, our platforms are at least independent businesses. They do not have a vested interest in undermining our basic democratic system. Truth is, though, I can't say the same for TikTok, the fastest growing social media platform in the United States, whose parent company, ByteDance, is based in the PRC. Even as U.S. social media platforms have fumbled in the response to foreign influence operations, there was never any concern that these platforms were operating at the direction of a foreign adversary. Again, I cannot say the same for TikTok. I yield back to Senator Cantwell.
Well, I thank Senator Warner for his perspective as chairman of the Intelligence Committee and his hard work. He and I both introduced legislation more than a year ago, trying to give our government the tools to deal with this issue. In 2020, India concluded that TikTok and other Chinese-controlled apps were national security threats and prohibited them. And as a result, India TikTok users migrated to other platforms, including Google's YouTube, and Indian small businesses found other ways to operate on other platforms. This supplemental contains the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Application Act. Congress has a non-punitive policy proposal in passing this legislation. Congress is not acting to punish ByteDance, TikTok, or any other individual company. Congress is acting to prevent foreign adversaries from conducting espionage, surveillance, maligned operations, harming vulnerable Americans, our servicemen and women, and our U.S. government personnel.
Senator Maria Cantwell, Democrat from Washington State, Chair of the Commerce Committee, and Senator Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, Chair of the Intelligence Committee on the Senate floor on the potential TikTok short video app ban in the U.S. that's contained in the $95 billion foreign aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. A story from The Hill, a final vote could take place as early as Tuesday night if both parties yield back enough of the 30 hours required between cloture and final passage. If no time is yielded back, a final passage vote would be set for Wednesday night. As always, you can follow the Senate live, gavel to gavel, on C-SPAN 2 television, on the C-SPAN Now mobile app, and streamed at cspan.org. Story from the New York Times. As a wave of pro-Palestinian activism on college campuses showed few signs of abating on Tuesday, the demonstrations have raised new questions about what shape the end of the semester may take for thousands of students across the United States. At Columbia University, where the arrests of more than 100 protesters unleashed a flurry of national protests, students will have the option to attend their last week of classes remotely for safety reasons. Several schools across the Northeast closed parts of their campuses to the public in an effort to conclude the year quietly. And at the University of Michigan, leaders were already looking ahead and bracing for graduation. They set up designated areas for demonstrations and said that administrators would generally be patient with lawful disruptions. That was from the New York Times. Former President Donald Trump spoke about the protest this morning as he made his way into the courtroom in New York City for his hush money criminal trial.
What's going on at the college level and the colleges, Columbia, NYU, and others, is a disgrace. And it's really on Biden. He has the wrong signal. He's got the wrong tone. He's got the wrong words. He doesn't know who he's backing. And it's a mess. And if this were me, it'd be after me. It'd be after me so much. But they're trying to give him a pass. But what's going on is a disgrace to our country. And it's all Biden's fault, and everybody knows it. He's got no message. He's got no compassion. He doesn't know what he's doing. He can't put two sentences together, frankly.
What would you do?
He is the worst president in the history of our country. And again, what's going on is a disgrace. Now, it's interesting outside. For great Americans, people that want to come down and they want to protest at the court, and they want to protest peacefully, we have more police presence here than anyone's ever seen. For blocks, you can't get near this courthouse. And yet you have nobody up at a college where you have very radical people wanting to rip the colleges down, the universities down. And that's a shame. but it all starts with Joe Biden. The signals he puts out are so bad. And I can tell you, he's no friend of Israel, that's for sure. And he's no friend of the Arab world either. You take a look at what he said. He's no friend of... He doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know what to do. He wants to take like a middle ground, and oftentimes that doesn't work, but it's certainly not working here. But what he's done to Israel is abandoned them, and he's trying to be as nice as he can to the other side. Call it the Arab world, but that's not working either, because they get him, and he's an incompetent man. A peace will never happen with a guy like this.
Former President Donald Trump, 2024 Republican presidential nominee, expected, speaking outside the courtroom on the 15th floor of New York County Supreme Court, 100 Center Street in Lower Manhattan. As he was speaking down at street level, NBC News correspondent Vaughn Hilliard was posting a video of what was happening on the street, and he writes on X, "Trump just claimed that the police have shut down the streets around the courthouse for blocks and that his protesters can't be here. Just not true. There is one pro-Trump person here, and the main street along the courthouse is open to the public." Story from The Hill, GOP senators sent a letter to Biden administration officials Tuesday demanding they restore order to college campuses amid contentious pro-Palestine protests. Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas, and 26 other Senate Republicans sent a letter to Education Secretary Miguel Cardona and Attorney General Merrick Garland, telling them to restore order to campuses that have been effectively shut down by anti-Semitic mobs that are targeting Jewish students. The students are demanding their schools divest from Israel and those associated with the current war, but the protests have faced bipartisan accusations of anti-Semitism and calls to violence. That from The Hill. The White House Deputy Press Secretary Andrew Bates was asked about the Biden administration's response to the college protests at a news conference aboard Air Force One.
Speaking on behalf of the White House and also the president had condemned the anti-Semitism we're seeing from college campuses and some of these protests. And I'm wondering if the White House is doing more. Are you reaching out to some of these schools, offering sort of support or anything along those lines as these situations continue?
As you mentioned, and as all of you covered in the president's Passover statement, he directly addressed the vile comments that circulated over the weekend with a call to action saying that we must speak out against the alarming surge of anti-Semitism because silence is complicity. Like we said, while every American has the right to peaceful protest, calls for violence and physical intimidation targeting Jewish students and the Jewish community are blatantly anti-Semitic, unconscionable, and dangerous. And they have no place on any college campus or anywhere in the United States of America. Echoing the rhetoric of terrorist organizations, especially in the wake of the worst massacre committed against the Jewish people since the Holocaust, is despicable. We are, of course, monitoring these situations closely. There has been alarming rhetoric that we want to be sure we are meeting our responsibility to speak out against. We will continue to do that. And that is a commitment the president made in the first ever national strategy to counter anti-Semitism. That is something he feels very strongly about. You all remember that he made the decision to run because of the anti-Semitic bile that was chanted in Charlottesville, and that is something he will continue to do.
The White House Deputy Press Secretary Andrew Bates meeting with reporters on Air Force One. White House said today that President Biden will be giving commencement addresses this year at Morehouse College, an historically black college, in Georgia on May 19th and at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point on May 25th. From NBC News, President Joe Biden is traveling to Florida on Tuesday to deliver remarks highlighting efforts by Democrats to safeguard abortion access and casting former President Donald Trump as a threat to reproductive rights. The Biden campaign has been emphasizing what it sees as a potential path to victory in a red state it considers winnable, despite Trump's victories there in 2016 and 2020. That was from NBC News. A six-week abortion ban in Florida will take effect May 1st, and there is a proposed constitutional amendment on the ballot in Florida in November to protect abortion rights, which will need at least 60% to succeed. Here's President Biden in Tampa.
Next week, one of the nation's most extreme anti-abortion laws will take effect here in Florida. It's criminalizing reproductive health care for before women even know whether they're pregnant. I mean, this is bizarre. You can put a doctor in prison if he takes care of a patient, as you just heard some version of from Louisiana. You know, this extreme Florida law is going to impact 4 million women in the state of Florida. Florida is one of the 21 states in America where you can't get access you need for care. This adds up to 1 in 3 women throughout the United States of America have this limitation. For 50 years, the court ruled that there was a fundamental constitutional right to privacy. But 2 years ago, that was taken away. Let's be real clear. There's one person responsible for this nightmare, and he's acknowledged and he brags about it, Donald Trump. In fact, Trump's bragged about it overturning Roe v. Wade, which meant there's no federal right. No decision can be made. All those decisions made at the state level. A lot of people don't even know that and don't focus on it. So every state can make a decision. Well, you know, now Trump says the law is, quote, working the way it's supposed to. Trump goes on to say individual state laws are working, his words, brilliantly. Brilliantly. It's a 6-week ban in Florida. It's really brilliant, isn't it? Even before women know they're pregnant. Is that brilliant? Look, just take a look at Arizona. It goes all the way back to 1864 before Arizona was even a state, before women had the right to vote, concluding that that's the law of the land in Arizona. And today, MAGA Republicans refuse to repeal that ban in Arizona. Trump is literally taking us back 160 years. He says it's up to the states, and this is all about states' rights. But he's wrong. The Supreme Court was wrong. It should be a constitutional right in the federal Constitution, a federal right. And it shouldn't matter where in America you live. It's about, this isn't about states' rights, it's about women's rights. I mean this. Look, folks, now he's worried the voters will hold him accountable for saying he's responsible for getting Roe v. Wade overturned. Donald Trump is worried voters are going to hold him accountable for the cruelty and chaos he created. Folks, the bad news for Trump is we are going to hold him accountable. We are.
President Joe Biden in Tampa, Florida today. Florida's Voice News reporting a statement from Republican Party of Florida Chairman Evan Power on the president's visit. He writes, Floridians' top issues are immigration, the economy, and inflation. In all three areas, Joe Biden has failed. Instead of coming to talk to Floridians about manufactured issues, he should get to work solving the real issues that he has failed to lead on. We also welcome him to learn from the successes that has made Florida a beacon of freedom for the rest of the country. And he also said that Florida is now home to nearly 1 million more registered Republicans than Democrats. Back in Washington, D.C., the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, ATF, held an inaugural Gun Violence Survivors Summit. ATF, the Justice Department said, brought together more than 200 survivors of gun violence, members of law enforcement, U.S. attorneys, healthcare professionals, and victim advocates, and included the dedication of a new exhibit, The Faces of Gun Violence. One of the speakers, the Deputy Attorney General, Lisa Monaco.
I just spent some time in the Faces of Gun Violence exhibit. These beautiful photos bear tribute and pay tribute to 118 lives cut too short by gun violence. 118 individuals, 118 smiles and stories. They represent a fraction of the vast toll of gun violence that is perpetrated on our country every year. They are 118 souls who aren't with us today, but who live on in those who loved them most and knew them best. We stand together in recognition of that profound loss, alongside all those who've been touched by the tragedy of gun violence. We stand together in common cause to end gun violence and its devastation. and we stand together undaunted with resolve and hope for the future. Now, I know that when it comes to this issue, hope can be hard to hold on to, because every day, gun violence continues to devastate families and communities across this country. It's the leading cause of death for American children and teens, and it's responsible for more than 100 deaths of law enforcement officers in the line of duty over the past 2 years. But there are reasons for hope. Just look around this room. Survivors are here today to listen, learn, and tell their stories. Members of law enforcement are also here as fellow survivors to listen, learn, and tell their stories. We must come together. We must pull together, as we're doing today, to stop gun violence.
Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco at the Justice Department in Washington at the inaugural Gun Violence Survivors Summit. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi there. I'm Jonathan from C-SPAN, along with my colleague, Ben. Since C-SPAN's founding 45 years ago, the media world has changed. Remember when there were just a few TV channels? Now we've got streaming, social media, apps, and more.
Through all of this, C-SPAN has stayed true to its mission of giving you unfiltered access to government wherever you get your news. As we navigate this challenging media environment with fewer people subscribing to traditional cable packages, our funding has been impacted.
That's why we're asking for your help to keep going strong for another 45 years. Please donate today at cspan.org/donate. Your contribution, large or small, helps ensure at least another 45 years of witnessing democracy in action.
Keep C-SPAN thriving in today's ever-changing media landscape. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your gift today. Thank you.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. It's free and wherever you find your podcasts. A story from Bloomberg Law. The Supreme Court suggested that it may allow a limited opportunity for U.S. citizens to challenge a visa denial for their spouse. But the justices at argument on Tuesday left it unclear how helpful some leeway would be for those seeking to bring their loved ones to the U.S. Sandra Munoz, an American citizen, sued the State Department after her husband, Luis Asencio Cordero, a citizen of El Salvador, was denied a visa application. Under the doctrine of consular non-reviewability, courts generally can't review visa denials for non-citizens for any reason. But there is a limited exception when the decision impinges the constitutional rights of a U.S. citizen. In those cases, the government must provide a facially legitimate and bona fide reason for the denial. A trial court agreed with the State Department that Munoz couldn't challenge the denial and dismissed the case. But the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit vacated that decision. The appeals court said the denial affected Munoz's rights related to her marriage and that the State Department's bare-bones citation to the statute under which they denied Asencio Cordero's visa didn't provide the kind of facially legitimate reason necessary to avoid judicial review. Several justices appeared to agree that some limited judicial review was appropriate, but that Munoz was asking for too much. That was from Bloomberg Law. Here's part of the oral argument today, Justice Sonia Sotomayor questioning the Deputy Solicitor General, Curtis Gannon.
As I see the question, my way, she has a liberty interest in her marriage and having her husband visit. She doesn't have a liberty interest in having the visa granted, but she does have a liberty interest in knowing why and an opportunity to oppose it if there is an opposition that can be had. But the review would be very limited. In Din, we said the process due is just knowing the reason and a statutory citation because he's entitled to know, she's entitled to know, he was a terrorist. In a conviction, the husband has gotten full notice. All the grounds have been told to the wife because there's been a public adjudication of that ground. Similarly, with all the other examples you provide, full process has been provided. But what you're saying is I have a right, and judicially created, we're going to say there is no process whatsoever you're entitled to. Now you're saying You're entitled to what Congress permits you to have. And so the question is, what's that?
In this context, that's not even Mandel. Congress has specifically said that we don't have to give a reason at all if this is the reason for the denial. But I would say that we don't think that there is a separate category of liberty interest for getting information as opposed to the underlying liberty interest. And so the fact that she wants to live with her husband in the United States doesn't mean that she has a liberty interest in having information related to something that prevents her from prevents him from doing that. And I would also
say that
makes
little sense to me in the example I gave.
Pardon?
It makes little sense to me in the example I gave about the mistaken identity. She would be seeking to exercise her right to live with him on the ground that you don't have a statutory basis to exclude him.
But she doesn't have a constitutional right to participate in that proceeding and say you got this decision wrong. And
well,
that is not unusual that there are instances where nobody is able to get review. As Justice Kennedy's concurring opinion pointed out, we give the examples of the prisoner who is not able to challenge a transfer to a different prison, the soldier who is not able to challenge a military deployment. In Castle Rock, where the court relied on O'Bannon, that was an instance where nobody was able to get enforcement of that judicial of that restraining order.
You're not mentioning independent constitutional rights. All right. Thank you, counsel.
Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor questioning U.S. Deputy Solicitor General Curtis Gannon during oral argument in today's case, State Department v. Munoz. Courthouse News summarizing it. Supreme Court was doubtful on Tuesday that a U.S. citizen's spousal interest could overcome her El Salvadorian husband's immigrant visa denial for supposed gang tattoos. A second case today before the Supreme Court, and this from Reuters, the Supreme Court justices on Tuesday appeared to agree with Starbucks in the coffee chain's challenge to a judicial order requiring it to rehire 7 employees at a Tennessee cafe who were fired as they pursued efforts to unionize. The justices heard arguments in the company's appeal of a lower court's approval of an injunction sought by the U.S. National Labor Relations Board ordering the reinstatement of the workers. It is a case that could make it harder to bring a quick halt to labor practices challenged as unfair under federal law while the NLRB resolves complaints. That was from Reuters. Here's the portion of the oral argument. It begins with Starbucks attorney Lisa Blatt. Then you'll hear questions from Justice Clarence Thomas.
Section 10J authorizes district courts to grant preliminary injunctions that they deem just and proper. 10J thus requires district courts to apply the traditional 4 factors as set out in Winter versus NRDC. This court should reverse. The Court of Appeals held that Winter's 4 factors do not apply under Section 10J. All that mattered below was whether any facts supported a non-frivolous legal theory and whether there was harm, not whether that harm was irreparable. The government argues that whether a 2- or 4-part test governs, statutory context compels district courts to conduct, quote, a less exacting and more deferential inquiry into the merits without undertaking an intensive effort to resolve factual issues. But 10J contains no language, much less clear language, diluting the traditional standard. Preliminary injunctions are extraordinary and drastic remedies. Here, the board seeks a coercive injunction backed by contempt sanctions. And the board seeks the very same injunctive relief that it would get if it won the case. Such relief is highly inappropriate absent a clear showing under all 4 factors. The government justifies deference because the board, not trial courts, ultimately decide the merits at the back end. But Congress directed trial courts, not the board, to apply the Winter factors at the front end. The board hasn't even made any factual findings to defer to. Agencies have no expertise whatsoever in how courts should exercise their equitable discretion. Indeed, the board in its adjudication will not even consider the 4 Winter factors. This court has never deferred to an agency's litigation position, and it should not start here. I welcome your questions.
Ms. Blatt, the government says that petitioner's ahistorical, decontextualized approach is inconsistent with the statutory text, the basic premises of equity, and over a century of case law. What's your reaction to that?
No. I don't even know where they're getting that. I mean, this court in Winter and a million other cases have said that these four factors are longstanding, and the clear statement rule goes back to Justice Story. But I just think the text on its face, you don't have to get too far, says just and proper. That's obviously harks to traditional equity, and here we have the four factors.
Do you think the government argues that because they are protecting the board's jurisdiction as opposed to the court's jurisdiction, that that's a difference?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, a preliminary injunction, I mean, it's assigned to the district court. It has the same reasons. You have to show that there's a likelihood of success on the merits. And obviously, if the harm is recoverable, you're not entitled to the injunction at all in balance of the equities. There's no, I don't even understand the board's jurisdiction. There are a multitude of contexts where an agency has an adjudication. And if it wants a preliminary injunction, it's got to make the showing that every other party would have to make.
Lisa Blatt, attorney for Starbucks. And then you heard questions to her by Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas in the oral argument in the case today, Starbucks Corporation v. McKinney. Again, from the Reuters article, the case centers on the legal standard that federal courts must use to issue a preliminary injunction requested by the National Labor Relations Board under the federal law called the National Labor Relations Act. Such orders are intended as an interim tool to halt unfair labor practices while a case is proceeding before the board. You heard reference to 10J. That's part of this act. And this has to do with seven baristas at a Memphis Starbucks who were fired, allegedly for union organizing activity. C-SPAN Radio will have live coverage of two more Supreme Court cases this week. On Wednesday, 10 a.m. Eastern, Moyle v. United States, on whether a federal law that allows for emergency abortion health care at hospitals preempts state laws such as Idaho's Defense of Life Act, which bans nearly all abortions. And Thursday at 10 a.m. Eastern, U.S. v. Trump, whether former President Donald Trump is immune from criminal prosecution for his alleged role in trying to overturn the 2020 election results. Listen live on C-SPAN Radio. From USA Today, the Biden administration on Tuesday announced a new rule that would make millions of white-collar workers newly eligible for overtime pay. Starting July 1st, the rule would increase the threshold at which executive, administrative, and professional employees are exempt from overtime pay to $43,888 from the current $35,568. That change would make an additional 1 million workers eligible to receive time and a half wages for each hour they put in beyond a 40-hour week. And on January 1st, the threshold would rise further to $58,556, covering another 3 million workers. That was from USA Today. The acting Labor Secretary Julie Hsu spoke today at the North American Building Trades Union's Legislative Conference in Washington, D.C., about actions taken by the Biden administration, including requiring project labor agreements for large federally funded construction projects, change to how prevailing wage is calculated that increases pay to workers, and using registered apprenticeships.
Let's talk about registered apprenticeships. The last administration tried to weaken those too. They tried to say, we'll just set up a training program without skill standards, without wage progression, where your only option as a worker is to stay with that employer, and we'll call that an apprenticeship. Once again, we said, not on our watch. Registered apprenticeships are the gold standard. They're one of the most powerful ways that workers can find their place in the middle class. And we not only fought back on these fake apprenticeships, we're investing big in registered apprenticeships. And the Department of Labor has also invested in a partnership between NAPTU's Trades Futures and the National Urban League. That's a historic partnership to connect more communities to registered apprenticeships. In less than a year, we've enrolled over 3,700 people, including over 700 women and over 2,500 people of color in apprenticeship readiness programs. This is what it looks like. In Ohio, we're helping veterans get good-paying construction jobs. In Milwaukee and New York, Trades Futures offers childcare so that working parents can join the building trades. In North Dakota, we started the first ever pre-apprenticeship program with a tribal college. And it's absolutely essential that we continue to create these pathways for all of America's workers. I know this is something that you all care about. Opportunities for good jobs for all communities.
The acting Labor Secretary Julie Hsu today at the North American Building Trades Union Legislative Conference in Washington. The Federal Trade Commission voted 3-2 on Tuesday to ban non-compete agreements that prevents an estimated 30 million workers from working for competitors or starting a competing business after they leave a job. Wall Street today, the Dow up 263, NASDAQ up 245, S&P up 59. The acting Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Adrian Todman, has been in that role for about a month, taking over after former Secretary Marsha Fudge resigned. Today, the acting secretary was at the Bipartisan Policy Center for a conversation about housing shortages and availability.
Do you see the housing affordability problem really as a sort of a mismatch between the demand, the great demand for housing, and available supply?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's not lost on anybody who pays attention to this how far behind we are as a country in the number of units we need, upwards of about 3 million. And it began in just after the Great Recession, where it was hard to get credit. It was just hard to build. And there was a number of particularly single-family homes on the market that sort of absorbed some of the demand. But here we are. Here we are several years later, and we do see that we have fallen behind. And so one of the reasons that we have been very intentional on our supply action plan, again, even in the face of not having all the resources that we need, is making sure we're doing everything we can to help localities and governors. One of the things that I'm particularly proud of is our pro-housing program. We talk a lot about resources, but we also need to make sure that we're creating an environment where housing can be built at all.
Now, the pro-housing program, that provides grants to local communities?
Right. It's a new program. It's going to provide 85...
Funded by the Congress.
Funded by the Congress, a very bipartisan way. $85 million that will go to states, localities, others to really incentivize and motivate folks to be to remove the barriers to building more housing, whatever those barriers may be at the local level. And so we are poised and getting ready to release those awards this spring.
Acting Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Adrian Todman at the Bipartisan Policy Center today. Politico reported March 15, shortly after she took over as acting secretary, that President Joe Biden is considering not naming a permanent replacement for departing HUD Secretary Marsha Fudge, despite housing advocates' plea for a successor. The administration, which is considering nominees and still weighing the decision, would be faced with trying to push a nominee through the closely divided Senate just months before the November vote. And that Fudge's sudden decision to retire has put the White House in a difficult position, just as Biden is emphasizing the need to bring down housing costs. Home prices in the 20 largest metro areas in the U.S. hit a new high in December, and rent prices have surged nearly 30% since the start of the pandemic. That was a story from Politico. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter, Word for Word, and get the stories making headlines in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.